This podcast may have explicit content and also has this implicit request. If you follow me on Twitter, why not follow The Gist at Slate Gist? It's Wednesday, February 20th, 2019 from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And yes, I am back from vacation. When I was gone, I found out the internet had just discovered that apparently John Wayne Gacy was this terrible person and people were all upset. John Wayne Gacy, I don't know why they selected John Wayne Gacy. Maybe it's an answer to the Ted Bundy boomlet. That's not, oh, hold on. I'm told I'm wrong. I'm getting it wrong. It wasn't John Wayne Gacy, the serial killer. It was John Wayne, just regular old John Wayne, American icon. And people found an infamous 1971 interview he gave to Playboy. Infamous, because I knew about it. I knew he had these thoughts. I knew it was part of the Playboy interview. But while infamous, not famous enough, I guess, to the internet and Twitter, spent some time canceling John Wayne, who died like 20 years ago. Canceling the Duke, like Snake Plissken canceled the Duke. Like Mercer College in 2014 or Lehigh in 2012 canceled the Duke. They're a little Escape from New York and March Madness humor for you. You know, the state of Illinois canceled John Wayne Gacy in 1994. So John Wayne, there we are. We spent a little time raking the fellow over the coals. Please no one tell the internet about Charles Lindbergh. So what happened while I was gone for a couple days? Well, Roger Stone was intent on incriminating himself. A former FBI employee wrote a book and made the rounds detailing crazy interactions with the president. And the Times had a big story which went deep inside the West Wing's bizarre obstruction of justice defense. Guys, you know the definition of news is that which is new, right? I could have read all of those headlines from various weeks during the year. One thing I couldn't have read or couldn't have said was, Barry Lamb, thank you for hosting The Gist. Thank you, Barry. I got to spend some time, not just with John Wayne, but another American movie icon with no baggage of the unwoke variety, a Mr. Walt Disney. Yes, I went to Disney World, a place founded by a man whose politics are so pristine that no one could wait. I'm being told there was actually some baggage. Really? Walt Disney? You're not thinking about serial killer Walter Elias Disney, who believed animals could talk and who wound up going on a killing spree of mothers? You know, Dumbo's mom, Bambi's mom, Jungle Book, Little Mermaid, Nemo, Frozen, Lilo, Up. Dead mom, dead mom, dead mom, dead mom, dead mom, dead mom and dad, dead wife who never had kids. Oh, that is the real Walt Disney. Well, here is a preview from what I like to call Tomorrowland, which is to just say tomorrow's show. It will be Disneyland, a Gist cultural appraisal. Oh, wow. That should be great. According to the app, the wait time on that spiel is around 23 hours. Today's spiel is about Bernie Sanders's presidential candidacy. Again, folks, the definition of news is that which is new. But first, before we get to Bernie, there is a flag emergency in the land, and when a flag emergency hits, the Gist hits back with a roundhouse of research and an uppercut of insight. Well, actually, we outsource all that to flag expert Ted Kay. Once more, we convene a vexillology corner topic, the flag of San Francisco. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The city of San Francisco is many things to many people, but to vexillologists, it is a vexing municipality because there they have a phoenix and they have some Spanish words and they have quite large on the bottom the words San Francisco. And I've got to tell you, from such a fashionable, forward-thinking city, it is not the prettiest or possibly even the best flag. Well, to discuss San Francisco's flag, I am joined and we convene once more another edition of Vexillology Corner. This is Ted Kaye joining me. He's the editor emeritus of Raven, which is, of course, the official publication, the Journal of Vexillology. He is the secretary of NAVA, which is the North American Association of said Vexillology. You also know him from the book Good Flag, Bad Flag. Hello, Ted. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Let's talk San Francisco, shall we?
Yes.
Before, every once in a while, I do find that this city's flag or that city's flag bubbles up. But before they bubble up, do you have a general sense of the biggest cities and their flags and which ones are good ones and which ones are bad ones? What I'm asking is, when people started talking about San Francisco, did you immediately say, yes, I knew this day was coming?
Certainly. San Francisco's is a reasonable flag that could be made much better. And San Francisco is a great city. I lived there myself for many years and wish the flag were a better representation of the city.
Now, if we go by the good flag, bad flag principles, what's good and what's bad about what the flag looks like now?
It's not simple enough. Could be simplified. It does have meaningful symbolism. The phoenix on it represents San Francisco growing back after the terrible fires of the 1850s.
Yes.
It has many more colors than it needs. It's got writing on it, which is a bad idea, and it's reasonably distinctive. So it works on two out of five principles and falls short on three of the other five.
Right. So although the writing, it says San Francisco, so I usually object to very literal writing. This is us. Like, that's what a flag should do, is take the place of writing. But it also has a motto, and I grade on a curve when it comes to mottos or I don't even know if it's the official motto, but words that are perhaps incorporated into a pre-existing seal. I think that's a little different from just writing the name of your city on the flag.
Correct. And usually those words are so small, it doesn't matter because you can't see them. So it's just wasted ink on the flag. But the words San Francisco were actually placed on the flag in 1940 because they said, well, nobody knows that this is our flag, so we better put our name on it.
Yeah, that's a great sign. You got a bad flag.
Yeah, if you have to write the name of your place on your flag, then your symbolism has failed you.
Yeah, so I'll describe it. It is all bordered in a fair gold or yellow, they would say, and it's a fairly thick border, and then the rest of the field is white, and then there is a phoenix looking quite serious facing Dexter flank, I think we would say, in the flag game. The phoenix is rising out of fire, as a phoenix does, and under it there is a banner. Perhaps you could use the vexillology term of how this banner is arrayed, and the words on the banner are Oro en Paz, Fiero en Guerra, which means gold in peace, iron in war. And then the biggest letters on the flag are under that in blue, San Francisco. A little busy.
A little busy. Interesting point about the gold border. It was a drafting mistake in 1940 when they readopted an ordinance to put the word San Francisco on the flag. Somebody had seen the gold fringe on the previous flag and said, oh, it's bordered in yellow. And then that got written into the official specifications for the flag. And somebody misinterpreted that as being a gold border actually on the flag.
Interesting. Do you think that gold border works, or should they scrap that if they redesign it?
The gold border is actually quite distinctive among city flags, among many flags, and that may be one of the most distinctive parts of the flag, this inadvertent drafting mistake that created a distinctive graphic symbol.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that whenever I see a flag that is mostly white without a border, sometimes I don't know when it ends.
And certainly flying against a white sky, that's true. And when it's placed on a white background, you can't see where it ends. Interesting, a gold border, San Francisco, the Golden Gate, exists as a modern city because of the gold rush. Gold's a good color for San Francisco.
Absolutely. So have you seen many designs or redesigns or proposed redesigns of what San Francisco could go with?
Sure. Roman Mars launched an effort after he did his TED Talk in 2015 calling for designs for a new flag for the city of San Francisco. Other people have taken him up on that challenge. There's a couple of young San Franciscans, Connor Nakamura and Una Fitzpatrick, who have started a campaign to change the flag. There's a couple graphic designers in San Francisco who have come up with their own designs, Peter Noel and Josh Silverman. And recently, in the last couple of weeks, a consultant on city brand identity, Lev Kushner, wrote an op-ed piece in the San Francisco Chronicle. And the Chronicle has started a competition to ask people to propose designs. So the pot is being stirred for new designs for San Francisco's flag.
When municipalities do decide on a flag overhaul, is it often by something like the paper of record taking it up as a cause? Does that often cause change?
That's one of the four major ways that flag change gets spurred. The media can take it up. A graphic designer or an artist says, I've got a new design, or we ought to have a new design. A general activist who says, we can do better than this flag that we've got, let's change it. And then the fourth might be somebody within the city government itself, the mayor or somebody on the city council or on the city staff. So media, artist, activist, and city employee, those are the four different areas that tend to spur flag design change in cities.
Yeah. And do you get the sense that this is moved beyond a clever op-ed and podcaster passion?
A key issue is getting the elected leaders of the city on board with the idea that a great city deserves a great flag and that the current design is failing the city and should be upgraded.
Uh-huh.
Without that kind of political support for the change, nothing's going to happen. We'll have nice competitions. People will talk about it, but it won't change. But it takes leadership and vision for city political leaders to be willing to invest political capital in a change because they can see that that change can reflect positively on the city going forward.
So describe some of the new ideas, new designs for flags that of San Francisco that you like or don't like or think are interesting.
I've seen some very interesting ones that have vague graphical allusions to the Golden Gate Bridge, with that international orange color it's a slightly darker reddish orange color of the Golden Gate. But not a depiction of the bridge, but just allusions to it, which is probably a great way to do it. If you think of San Francisco, there are actually many tangible objects that can represent San Francisco. But the Golden Gate Bridge is probably the most iconic among them. And having something that refers to its colors or its overall shape on the flag is very exciting. I've seen allusions to the sun, to gold, to the bay itself, and all of those can come out well in a city flag. But there's nothing like unleashing the creativity of the public and crowdsourcing flag design to have some great designs come forward that one would never have otherwise thought of.
Yes, on a subreddit group for Vexillology in San Francisco. There are a lot of good variants of the Phoenix. Most of them retain goldenness. I think that there's, I mean, probably because San Francisco is such a community rich with excellent artists, there are a lot of good choices. But I also see them there being a temptation. And a writer to the Chronicler had his own flag. And the temptation is to emphasize the inclusivity of San Francisco, the diversity of San Francisco. And I get that. But the problem is diversity on a flag usually means many colors, and many colors or many things on a flag runs counter to the principles of a good flag, does it not?
Indeed. I like to refer to the case of Australia, which not only has a national flag, but has a policy that it also has to fly in public places the flag of the Aboriginal people and the flag of the Torres Strait Islanders. So Australia, in attempting to be diverse, is actually forcing itself to use three different flags to represent its country, when it really should stop using those three as different flags, but come up with one flag that represents all of Australia, the place and the people.
But can it do that? Can it do that while being succinct enough to actually say something? Because if you try to say everything, you say nothing.
Well, that's the point. Don't try to say everything. Try to say one thing on your flag. One of the best city flags, since we're talking about Phoenixes, is the flag of the city of Phoenix, Arizona. It's purple, which is the traditional Phoenix Phoenician royal color associated with Phoenixes. It's got a stylized Phoenix on it. And I would say that it's one of the very few city flags in the United States where you can look at it and actually make a very educated, successful guess of what city it represents.
Yeah.
I mean, a flag with a great big Phoenix on it is probably representing Phoenix, Arizona.
That's true.
It's a stunning flag. It says nothing about inclusivity per se. It says everything about unity and definition of what the city is.
So where do you see this going? What is the next step for should San Francisco actually redesign their flag?
The next step is getting the mayor or the board of commissioners to agree that it's a good idea to change the flag. And that agreement happens before the new design or designs get considered. In other words, they need to decide to jump into the pool,
right,
and then they can start swimming around and look at new designs.
Right. That's really important because we've talked about this before. If they do it the other way, people usually retreat back to what is familiar.
That's correct. There's a psychological principle called the mirror exposure effect, which I've editorialized about, and I was delighted to see Lee Kushner referring to in his op-ed piece in the Cron, that people prefer things they're familiar with. Whether they're good or bad or ugly or beautiful, it's the familiarity that makes them feel comfortable and prefer them. And we need to get over that mirror exposure effect when taking the leap to a new design. Now, once that leap has occurred, say South Africa in 1994 or Canada in 1964-65, at the beginning of that, people hate the new design.
Yes.
The maple leaf flag and the new South African flag were widely derided. And within a couple years, though, people came around, and now you can't find hardly anybody who would say, I prefer the old South African flag. I prefer the old red ensign for Canada.
Right. Right. Well, with South Africa, it's especially fraught. But with Canada, I mean, their designation, I think their technical designation as part of the Commonwealth might have been tweaked. But yeah, that old flag was really busy, and it had a shield, and it had, you know, a third of it or a quarter of it was the British flag. The maple leaf is so iconic. It's one of the best flags ever.
Indeed, but it didn't start out being popular, is my point.
Right.
People had to get used to it.
Ted Kay is, so many things. Author of Good Flag, Bad Flag, and he is a former editor of Raven, the Journal of Vexillology. He is the secretary of the North American Vexillological Association. Thank you, Ted. Oh, wait, and when we convene a Vexillology Corner, he's the man we convene it with. Thank you, Ted.
You're too kind. Thank you.
And now the spiel. Bernie Sanders is running for president. Not a huge shock. His message, also pretty familiar. If you forgot why the socialist senator is a socialist, he spells it out right here.
To me, what socialism means is democracy. It means doing away with a system where 1% of the population owns half of the wealth, where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
The crazy thing about crazy Bernie, which is the phrase used by our actual DSM-5 president, the crazy thing about crazy Bernie is he seems to be caught in a time loop or a time crunch or a little bit of a squeeze. Because that clip I played, that was from 1989. Bernie Sanders will be 79 years old if he is elected, which seems to me the biggest reason why he won't be elected. So if you're 79 when you're elected and you serve your whole term, you'll be 83, and 83 in the last year of Bernie Sanders' first term. That's just older, I think, than most Americans want their president to be. But if a 47-year-old Bernie were running today, he just might have a very good shot. That clip, which was pulled from a CBC profile of Burlington's socialist mayor, Bernie Sanders, shows Bernie Sanders at 47. And what he looks like is a little bit like Bernie Sanders today, combined with maybe with Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters. Not exactly the look, but the vibe. A rumpled suit, an unruly shock of hair enveloping the side of his head like a cumulus cloud, but a largely unwrinkled face. But the 47-year-old Bernie couldn't win then, because then was 1989. It was a time of Reaganomics and mourning in America. Socialism was more than just a cudgel used by lazy right-wingers who lack a substantive charge. Socialism back then was very real. It animated our gravest enemies. 1989 was a time of Alex P. Keaton, not of Eugene V. Debs. Cut to 2019, and Bernie Sanders sounds exactly the same, but he's aged out of the presidency, just as society, or at least the Democratic Party, has caught up with his politics. Perhaps you could argue has been, to some extent, subsumed by his politics. Now, I don't want to be ageist, and I honestly don't recall Bernie having a senior moment where you could say, well, that's an effect of his age. When he says wild things, they are exactly the wild things that he means to say. But think about the famous 83-year-olds. What's an 83-year-old? Maybe you have a parent or grandparent in your life of that age. Maybe that comforts you. Maybe that worries you. I Googled people who were born in 1936, which means they could be 82, but they could be 83. Eight of the first 10 most famous people, at least that this site returned, are celebrities like John McCain and Burt Reynolds and Jim Henson, Mary Tyler Moore, and they all share a certain quality. They're all dead. But also on that list was Buddy Holly. I blame his death more on the plane than something like high cholesterol, but you never know. He could have had a massive heart attack because of, you know, blockage of the arteries right before impact. The Pope, our current Pope, he's 82. So, vibrant, globe-trotting leader, it is still possible. I do have to say, it seems to me that America's problems are a little bit harder than the Pope's problems. I mean, if America's biggest problem was a wave of priest dads, I think the job will be easier. And the last time I checked, you can't excommunicate the Republican Party, so being president might be harder. Robert Redford's only 82. That argues for an 82-year-old being able to do the job, or seeming they're able to do the job. And again, I will admit to being a bit unfair and a bit ageist. On the other hand, cognitive decline is real. The current president seems to be experiencing it to some degree. And he didn't start from as powerful a baseline as he would have you believe. But I want to talk about substance, because there's another Achilles heel to go along with the arthritic knees common to the aged. And your host, Bernie Sanders, is a socialist. That we know, which means he's a believer in programs like free college for all and nationalized health care. He has arguments for all of these, that we'd be foolish not to spend the money. He could do some deflection and say, how come the same questions aren't asked about the military? Fine, we know what he's going to say. But at some point, this is what I think is going to happen. Some reporter, maybe someone else in a debate, will pin him down on the economic theory known as MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. Now, MMT, if you haven't heard of it, it's a way of describing how debt and deficits and spending actually, they say, works versus how we think it works. If you have heard of MMT, you will find the description I'm about to give totally inadequate. You'll deluge me with insulting tweets and emails because I didn't go into a 35-minute explanation, you know, really 2-hour, 35-minute at the very minimum, because people people who are really into MMT don't look at it like an economic theory. They look at it like a fundamentalist looks at a sacred text. They're a lot like the peak oil crowd or the gold guys. They're similarly passionate. They have some stats on their side, but also there are times when their passion overwhelms their logic and gets in the way of their capacity to say simply, "Oh, I see we disagree." Bernie Sanders, last time out, had two main economic advisors. One was James K. Galbraith of Texas. He's an MMT guy. The other was Stephanie Kelton, now of Stony Brook University. Last time around, from the University of Missouri at Kansas City. So she went from kangaroo to seawolf, if you're playing at home. The basic premise of MMT, not the explanation part where they say this is how the world really works, but the prescription part, where they say, and therefore we should do this. It's all explained in this tweet from Stephanie Kelton. She tweeted out a couple weeks ago, at Stephanie Kelton. Question, can we afford a hashtag Green New Deal? Answer, yes. The federal government can afford to buy whatever is for sale in its own currency. Mm-hmm. This is the premise. There's no such thing as deficits. All deficits are is taking government money and giving it to the people of America. Therefore, it's the same money just held by different people. She'd prefer it was held by Americans, not the government. Well, this is from a lecture that Stephanie Kelton gave at Stony Brook. She asked us to consider debt and deficits, not as debt and deficits, but as dollars being held by the people.
So the entire national debt is nothing more than a record, a historical record, of all of the dollars that were spent into the economy, not taxed back, and are currently being held in the form of U.S. treasuries. That's all the national debt is.
Kelton is right. I'll give her credit. She's right on a couple of points. We have been overly panicked about deficits past. That doesn't mean, though, they're not concerning or should never be concerning. She gave a TED-esque talk. She had one of those wraparound wireless headphones. I think a little bit of mouth noise there. Could have used a drink. But what she did was she showed us editorial cartoons and headlines throughout the years worrying about much lower debt and deficits, much lower than today's $22 trillion debt.
This is a cartoon from a newspaper in 1937. Okay, this is when, oh my God, the national debt is $36 billion with a B, billion dollars, right? High as a skyscraper, taller than Mount Everest and all that kind of stuff, right? So then from 1937, move through the 1940s, financing World War II, the national debt grows. All of a sudden, it's $49 billion with an expectation we're going up to $65 billion. Oh, the water's fine. Don't worry, right? It's all a big joke. Gloom and doom. Ronald Reagan finishes and they erect a monument in this cartoon. This is Reagan's legacy, $1.5 trillion, now with a T. And then $3 trillion. And then when Clinton leaves office, $5.7 trillion.
Yes, there has been fear-mongering about the debt. But just because there's been fear-mongering doesn't mean there's nothing to fear. I mean, I can find a lecture from some rabbi or Jewish leader in Germany in 1932 saying, look, we Jews, we're always worried about the anti-Semitism. Here's a cartoon, here's a headline to prove my point. Kelton properly critiques bad arguments. Current debt levels aren't a millstone that will surely sink us. And yes, I too hate those analogies between the federal budget and a household budget. Those are terrible. And of course, deficit hawks are really, really hawkish when it comes to helping poor people, I find. They're a lot less hawkish when it comes to paying for war. But it is funny that Stephanie Kelton, one of the two official Bernie Sanders economic advisors, and Dick Cheney agree. Dick Cheney said Ronald Reagan proved deficits don't matter. Here's Cheney expounding on that point a few years ago on CNN.
I'm not opposed under certain circumstances to running deficits. The debt is another problem, and we've gotten to the point now where, especially because of entitlement programs, but because it really hasn't been much done by way of trying to restrain spending, we now have, you know, $1 trillion deficits every year and a $17 trillion debt that we're passing on to our kids and grandkids. That concerns me.
But Stephanie Kelton is unconcerned, and she is in the enviable position of never being able to be proved wrong, until which time she is proved spectacularly, catastrophically wrong. And I guess we all say, whoops. I mean, it's not like there aren't countries that just printed their own money and it came back to bite them in the ass. Countries like Zimbabwe to Germany in the 30s. Bad example, she says. Let me give you an example of what happened. Bill Dudley, senior research scholar at Princeton now. He's the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York from 2009 to 2018. He did an article for Bloomberg and argued that, yeah, deficits still matter. And he says MMT hasn't worked out well for other countries. Consider Germany in the 1920s or Venezuela and Zimbabwe more recently. So Kelton retweets the response to that argument from a money manager guy named Mark Dow. Here was the response to the MMT not working out well for Germany in the 20s, Venezuela, or Zimbabwe. He writes, "The least discussed aspect of MMT is the role of policy credibility. Suggesting it would be a disaster in obscure country X, and therefore it would be a disaster in the US, means you don't understand it and should STFU." I'll tell you what that means in a second, but I want to recap what went on here. The former chair of the New York Fed, for 10 years, the chief economist at Goldman Sachs, doesn't properly understand this monetary theory and therefore should shut the fuck up. Because in Germany, which even after World War I was one of the two or three biggest economies in the world before hyperinflation killed it, because Germany was just obscure country X. And Stephanie Kelton, Bernie Sanders' top economic advisor, subscribes to the notion that shut the fuck up is the right policy. All right, I'm pulling back now. I'm pulling back to what I'm talking about, which is Bernie Sanders' viability. It's not about MMT per se. It's not about Stephanie Kelton. It's about Bernie Sanders' vulnerability. I predict that one day, by another candidate, by the media, he'll be pressed. He'll be made to answer, do you agree with MMT? And I don't think he'd say, I don't really know what that is. They're going to get an answer. And if his answer is no, not really, or it's an interesting idea, then the obvious follow-up is, then why is your top economic advisor an advisor? The leading lights on this issue. I mean, it is clear that all of his policies depend on an MMT view of the world. And then when whoever is pressing them makes him say, so therefore you're saying there's no such thing as not being able to afford something, he will not have a good answer. Oh, the MMT crowd will gnash and wail and point out, how dare you? The question's shallow. It doesn't appreciate the depth and wisdom of this serious theory, which very, very few academics adhere to. But it will hurt him. It will hurt him if he has to admit, or if he tries to lie, which Bernie Sanders doesn't usually do, to try to get out of admitting that this all depends on MMT, which isn't necessarily a crackpot theory. It's maybe an interesting thought exercise, but it's no theory upon which to run a country. I predict this will be a really tough position for Bernie to be in, and I think this belief, more than his age or more than just the label socialist, will not go down well in this newly progressive Democratic Party. Or I could be wrong. I didn't think Bernie would get as far as he did last time. I also could be wrong about MMT, and it's just the right way to see the world. And we could afford anything that's for sale in U.S. dollars. Of course, if I'm wrong, where's Zimbabwe? And yes, I acknowledge the reasoned critique of that concern. And I shall now shut the fuck up. That's it for today's show. That just was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader. Do you have a theory about the economic conditions in such obscure countries as Madagascar, Albania, and the entire Holy Roman Empire? TJ Raphael is the Gist's senior producer. She has uncovered a very troubling interview that Anita Bryant once gave. Did we know this nice orange juice lady had bizarre theories on social policies? The Gist. All right. First, we redesigned the flag of San Francisco. Next up, Menlo Park. I propose the new flag just be a meme version of the old flag with fist pump baby on the hoist side and a thumbs up on the fly. Oompru-dapru-doo-pru, and thanks for listening.